The clerk will call the docket.
No MEDS Francis against National Accrediting Commission of Career Arts and Sciences, Inc. Michael E. Bede for the appellant, Jacqueline L. Thompson for the appellee.
You may proceed.
Good morning, and may it please the court. My name is Michael Veve, counsel for appellant. Our appeal assigns error by the Circuit Court of Alexandria when it sustained the employer's amended demurrer with prejudice of our amended complaint for wrongful discharge. As shown in our appellant briefs, our amended complaint properly pled sufficient material facts which met all the necessary legal requirements to establish a wrongful discharge claim in violation of established public policy in Virginia, pursuant to the Bowman Doctrine, as an exception to the Employment at Will Doctrine. Naomi Francis brought her wrongful termination action against her employer after she was abruptly fired without explanation and despite an excellent work record shortly after she had obtained a protective order against a fellow employee who had viciously assaulted her at work without provocation. The assault was witnessed by a dozen office employees, and during the assault, as pled in the complaint, Ms. Francis was fearful of her physical health, safety, and welfare. After the assault, the employer did not investigate the incident, did not allow Ms. Francis or her attacker to explain what had happened, did not discipline the attacker, and took no steps to protect Ms. Francis's safety and well-being at work. 1 week after the attack, Ms. Francis obtained an ex parte preliminary protective order against her attacker pursuant to Section 19.2-152.9 of the Code of Virginia. The order required the attacker not to commit further acts of violence, force, or threats against Ms. Francis, nor have contact with Ms. Francis except lawful contact.
Counsel, what specific established public policy is inherent in the protective order statute?
There is a section in the Virginia Protective Order Statute, which is at 19.2-152.10 capital A, and I quote, to protect the health and safety of the petitioners from an act of violence, force, or threat that may result in injury to person or property. It's an explicit public policy, not an implied.
That sounds like a general policy for the protection of health and welfare of the people, doesn't it?
Well, it's only applicable when you are the affected party.
Okay.
Now, the question is, Bowman is very narrow. Lockhart was quite a drama in the courts, and the response was to recognize a very narrow exception to at-will. And that, by acquiescence, has been the law since the General Assembly has not decided to change it. So there's got to be some articulation of a public policy that is more specific and pointed and focused than simply there's a statute out there, and she went and got a statutory right and she got fired. We've read your materials, they're very well done, but how do you articulate in a single line or two why this statute is within the narrow exception and the hundreds of other statutes out there may not be? Why is your statute different?
Two answers to that. In the first instance, Bowman had no explicitly articulated public policy in its shareholder statute. So that's my first point. The second point is Mitchum. In the Mitchum case, the court expressly said, look, when it comes to health and safety, There doesn't have to be an articulated, there can be an implied public policy. So I think we fall squarely within the Bowman situation and the Mitchum situation.
Well, how do you see that the employer violated what you perceive to be the public policy, which is to protect the health and safety of the petitioner? What did they do to endanger her health or safety?
The employer refused to take any steps to investigate or protect, leaving Ms. Francis no other option than to seek a protective order.
But that has nothing to do with her termination.
Well, I think the complaint does say that there was no reason stated for the termination. There seems to be a clear pretextual situation in her termination.
I think that it
was tied. I mean, here you have an employee with a perfect working record.
Well, I understand that. But my question really was one of how does the termination violate the public policy? How did them terminating her violate the public policy of protecting her health and safety?
Because an employer under a wrongful termination concept should not have the right to terminate an employee exercising a statutory right.
So you're saying retaliation. No, this is not retaliation.
Retaliation occurs when you have a case brought by an employee against an employer or a charge against an employer, and then the employer retaliates against the employee. That's retaliation. This is not a retaliation case.
What specific facts are alleged that ties the termination to the protective order? In other words, there was a series of events, discussions, allegations, etc. And that group includes the protective order. It began with the altercation, or I presume it began with something prior to the altercation, because those don't usually just bubble up out of nowhere. And at some point, she got a protective order. But I don't see the direct link or the causal link between the protective order and the termination.
There was no termination following the incident. After the protective order is served on a Thursday at the workplace, in front of the human resources director on the attacker, there is a termination the following Monday of Ms. Francis.
The only excuse occurs later in time.
Yes, much later in time. And the only reason she was given for termination was, quote, she did not fit the vision of the organization, unquote.
Well,
and that is,
In Virginia, you're allowed to terminate for good reason, bad reason, or no reason at all, outside of a context of this nature. If you say you don't fit our vision, there's thousands of Virginians who are terminated because they don't fit the vision of the corporation. In this instance, was it the obtaining of the protective order that is the alleged causal link, or the service of the protective order at the workplace?
We don't know the answer. All we know is that we pled on all fours the standards of both. Statutory right being exercised, explicit public policy, and a termination that certainly can be proven at trial was the cause of the termination, and that you don't fit the
organization
would be the pretext.
It seems like to me you're saying that the termination didn't violate the public policy, but it was related to the exercise of the right under the public policy.
I think there were two violations. There was the exercise of the statutory right by Ms. Francis.
Well, how is that a violation?
Well, I'm sorry, I misspoke. The violation occurs on the public policy side. There is a public policy in the state of Virginia which is explicit in the protective order statute to protect people's safety and health.
Right. And her health and safety was protected by
yes.
the protective order.
Yes. Okay. And therefore, upon obtaining the protective order, she is fired for having dared to obtain a protective order to protect her safety and health.
I
think her termination on that basis is a violation of the stated public policy in the Commonwealth of Virginia.
And what is that public policy that was violated by the termination?
It's the public policy that is explicit as well as implied in the protective order statute citation that I gave.
But what you stated as the public policy was the protection of the health and safety of the petitioner, correct?
Correct.
How does terminating her violate or in any way impugn her health or safety?
No different than the Bowman's fact situation.
No,
shareholders voting their shares and being terminated. And there was no even explicit public policy in the Bowman fact.
But the difference here, as Justice Goodwin's question is making to you, is you've got two employees at each other. The employer says, I don't want this drama at the work site. Now someone's having a deputy sheriff serve something in the office. What's unsafe or improper about saying, I'm separating the two? Which one should I separate? Who's at fault? How do I know? This is going to be going on for months. Well, I'm going to take the person out that I think is not fitting the vision of my shop and let them deal with their problems privately or in the court system. I just don't want it here at work. Now, as the way I've explained that narrative, I'm finding it hard to believe that there would be a public policy against that. It sounds like it's pretty good judgment.
Well, I think that what we have to weigh here is the applicability of the Bowman standards to this fact situation.
The best that your fact situation, the highest your fact situation rises in my mind, is that the individual was terminated for serving the protective order at the workplace.
Thereby, we don't know that, but that's part of the fact.
I think that's the highest your facts rise. And how does that violate the public policy of Virginia?
Because in Virginia, you shouldn't be terminated for exercising a statutory right that this whose same statute contains a public policy pronouncement.
But it wasn't the exercise of the statutory right. It was bringing a deputy into the workplace to say to a worker during the workday, here, I've got process to serve upon you.
But that may not have been what actually happened. I think we have a properly pled complaint to be able to go to trial.
You have no facts that indicate that the protective order itself was the cause. It's a conclusory statement. It's simply a subsequent in time. The only fact you have is that a deputy came into the workplace to serve it.
In the discrimination side of employment law, you do have pretextual situations. I think until we have evidence,
I understand very well the Title VII and the Pregnancy Disability Act and the pretext doctrine in federal court. That has not been applied in the Bowman scenario here.
Well, all I can say is that you have the clear facts before you. And the question is, was the complaint sufficient or not?
Well, the other difference in Bowman, though, too, isn't it that the stockholders are a specifically protected class, able to vote their shares free of intimidation and duress? So how do you say your client is a specifically protected class under the Bowman analysis?
I don't think there's any question that a victim of aggression is a designated protected class under the protective order statute. I have nothing further, Your Honors.
All right.
May it please the court. My name is Jacqueline Thompson. I'm here today representing the National Accrediting Commission of Career Arts and Sciences. And I do believe that the trial court in this case was correct in ordering the dismissal of this matter. The court has been very clear since Bowman was issued and all of the interpretation of Bowman in the 30 years since it's been decided, that it's meant to be a very, very narrow exception to at-will employment. And it's so narrow that there's only basically three scenarios that the Virginia courts entertain to be able to move a Bowman claim forward. Two are alleged here, but I think contrary to Ms. Francis's presentation claiming that her complaint falls into one of those scenarios, she's actually trying to fit a square peg into a round hole, that her complaint does not fall with any of the scenarios, and what she's actually asking the court to do is to expand the Bowman Doctrine and create a new exception that the court up until this point has not allowed. So, you know, I think this matter is very analogous to the court's analysis in City of Virginia Beach and in Rowan v. Tractor Supply, where the court acknowledged that certainly any statute that the General Assembly is going to enact is going to have some sort of public policy overview, or else the General Assembly...
Not everyone has a specific provision within it saying this is designed to protect health and safety. The General Assembly typically doesn't do that.
Yes, Your Honor.
So this is a different class of statute from that perspective.
Correct. You are correct.
So deal with that class of statutes, the very small minority that specifically say we're dealing with health and safety or we're dealing with the police power or whatever.
Yes, Your Honor. So this statute is a criminal procedure statute. I mean, the statute certainly says within the context of the language of the statute that it's for the health and safety of the petitioner, but that statute does not go beyond the specific right to obtain a protective order to then give the petitioner any sort of protection within the employment context. I don't think the General Assembly enacted the statute to then provide any protections beyond the specific fact of being able to obtain a protective order.
And the protective order would remain in effect irrespective of continued employment or termination of the employment.
Correct. That is correct.
So the objective of protecting health and safety would remain in place regardless of an employment decision.
Correct. But I think the converse to that statement would be if you allowed this sort of claim to go forward, that if an employee had a protective order, they're basically immune from any sort of termination decision because they had that protective order status.
Not necessarily, because all that would be is you would then, instead of getting kicked out on a demurrer or other procedural device, you would then go to trial, and then the employer would say, well, no, the reason we terminated them is because their performance was horrible or whatever, as opposed to then the plaintiff being able to say, no, the reason I was fired was because I got this protective order. That's all it does. It just gives the judge or the jury the chance to adjudicate something.
That's correct, Your Honor. It does. But I think that the way that Bowman has been interpreted over the last 30 years and the fact that every decision that comes down interpreting Bowman points to the fact that it's meant to be a very narrow exception is to eliminate the resources that have to go into taking something to trial when it's really not even properly pled to begin with at the complaint stage.
Isn't the irony here that by separating these employees by any method, you're obviously reducing the tension in the workplace, you're reducing the very context in which the alleged violence occurred to begin with. So unless we're expecting employers to adjudicate conflicts between employees, this is advancing, I would argue, the policy behind the statute, which is to reduce the possibility and the threat of conflict, particularly violent conflict. So that seems hard to... None of this makes sense to me in all candor.
Your Honor, I think that's correct. I mean, we're at a little bit of a disadvantage because we're obviously held to the facts that were pled in the amended complaint, and that's obviously not all of the facts that occurred during this situation. So I think your point is valid as far as, you know, certainly it's not going to be the employer's. You don't want to put that adjudication right onto the employers, but you also want to be able to have the employers, I think, like, I'm sorry, one of you pointed out earlier that, you know, disrupting the workplace and creating additional tension certainly should allow the employer to take an adverse action relative to that if it's creating a disruption in the workforce, and that's the whole point of the fact that Virginia very strongly adheres to outlaw employment. There's no dispute that she was an outlaw employee.
So if there were another conflict and it happened at the workplace, maybe half the office will have to march down to the General District Court or the Circuit Court and testify about a fight at the workplace. Why can't employers just say, I don't want that here? Bring it somewhere else, not here.
I think they absolutely can. I think that employers in Virginia have a lot of leeway to be able to handle those sort of conflicts in the best way that they think is going to move their business forward in the most tension-free way.
How many employees are in that office?
There are, at the time of this incident, there were, I believe, around 25 or 26. They've downsized since then. And now it's closer to 16 or 17.
You know, the preliminary protective order is one thing, and then the permanent order is another. And the permanent order says, shall have no contact whatsoever between the respondent and the petitioner.
Yes, Your Honor.
How do you conduct a business that small?
It's very difficult.
Unless you can have someone telecommute.
Right.
You just can't.
Exactly. I mean, I think exactly, obviously, the underlying facts are not within the appendix in front of you, but I think that that's exactly what this is getting to, is that when you have somebody coming in and creating this sort of tension, the employer certainly should have the ability to eliminate that. And if it's to do that through the termination of employment, that's certainly legal within the confines of the Commonwealth.
Is there anything further?
No, Your Honor, I just would like to reiterate that, again, I think that Ms. Francis's request here is not just that it was not decided correctly at the trial court. What she's actually asking is for an expansion of the very narrow Bowman doctrine and a creation of new law. And we just request the court to affirm the trial court's order.
All right. Counsel, you have a little over a minute left if you choose to use it.
Just a couple of very quick closing points. The protective order that was issued did not prevent lawful conduct. It wasn't...
No, that was the preliminary protective order. The second one said no contact.
Except lawful conduct.
No, that's the first preliminary order said that.
Okay.
The second one did not say
that. And
that
was not in effect when she was terminated.
Pardon?
That was the protective order in effect when she was terminated.
I see. All right. Thank you very much. Call the next case.